The most valuable commodity on Earth today is data. How we make it, use it, move it, and protect it. My name's David McCall. Join me today for the QTS Experience. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me on the QTS Experience today. I know I say this all the time, that I'm really excited about my guests, and I am, but this one is a rare privilege. I'm super stoked to have Professor Donald Sadoway on the show, and you will know why in just a moment, believe me. Let me briefly introduce Professor Sadoway. He's the John F. Elliott Professor of Materials Chemistry in the Department of Materials Science and Engineering at MIT. He's authored over 150 scientific papers. He holds 19 U.S. patents. He is the founder, scientific advisor, and board member at Ambry and Boston Metal. He's the founder of Sadoway Labs, Avanti Battery, Pure Lithium, and Lunar Resources. I could continue to list many other accolades. Please welcome Professor Donald Sadoway to the QTS Experience. Sir, thank you for joining.
Pleasure to be here.
So I was explaining to you when we were off air, I don't know why the universe gifted me with coming across your TED Talk from roughly a decade ago, maybe not quite a decade now, which was so entertaining and so brilliant and so relevant then to conversations we're having right now around sustainability. And when we say that, really in my world, the folks that we're talking to are around renewable energy, green energy, as it relates to reducing carbon emissions, sourcing power for, in my industry, data centers, but just in general, pretty interesting conversations. And I came across your TED Talk, which was specifically about, in this particular case, where you're innovating and the need for innovation, and through other talks, kind of where that's gone. So that'll be a fun conversation. But you said something in there that I loved: the impossible sometimes becomes the inevitable. And that's when I knew you had me, because I love engineers that are optimists, that are entrepreneurial, and they're a professor. It almost feels like you're a unicorn. Do you find that in the engineering world, that engineers are that optimistic and entrepreneurial as yourself? Is that a common trait?
Yeah, I think engineers are builders, and they are optimistic for sure.
Well, then I need to actually, I guess that's true. A friend of mine said we were talking about risks and technology, and he said, you know, look, when we invented the airplane, we also invented the airplane crash. But nobody, right? We're still going to continue to invent. We're going to improve. We're going to make it safer, better, and whatever. But there are risks that come on. But we, and that's how you know, it makes it easier to disperse global pandemics, but the benefits to the technology we invented so outweigh the risks that we need to continue to engineer and invent. So I thought that was a great analogy. When one of the other things that you've talked about, so today I'd love to talk about kind of three big ideas. You've talked about innovation, energy, what you're developing in the terms of energy storage in particular, and how you're also addressing some ideas and some big problems in manufacturing. So if we could start with innovation, when I heard you speak about this idea of innovation, what does that mean to you? And could you tease that idea out a little bit for us?
Well, I think there has to be a need. I look for unmet needs, and obviously it has to be within my area of technical expertise, which is, I would classify it as extreme electrochemistry. And I really like the notion of harnessing electrochemical approaches, because I view the future as, first of all, an electric future. And if you think about everything that we value that gives us our 21st century lifestyle, almost everything is predicated on the availability of electricity. So then if you add to that the concern about the CO2 and the need to decarbonize our industries, decarbonize transportation, decarbonize agriculture, decarbonize. So Well, that means electrify to me, because I can do everything, almost everything that is done chemically, I can do it electrochemically, put the electron to work. And then that means we install carbon-free generation of electricity, and we're there. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I start. And then I say, okay, well, what are the big ones? And I've looked at metal production, and we can talk about that. Mm-hmm. I arrived at molten oxide electrolysis for steel making. And I looked at batteries, and batteries both in mobile applications for transportation, mm-hmm. cars, electric vehicles, and certainly for the grid. You know, the way the grid operates, it's, people think it's like rain. You get bonus rain, you get extra water, you put it in a water tower, it's a bonus.
Right.
But that's not the way the grid operates. The grid operates such that supply must be in perfect balance with demand everywhere at all times. Mm-hmm. When you generate electricity, it goes into the wires. And if the demand isn't there, the grid is turning into this giant capacitor. Mm-hmm. And then the next guy who plugs in, instead of getting 110 volts at 60 hertz, you're getting 135 volts at 63 hertz, and you blow your devices. Mm-hmm. Imagine if every time you went to plug in your device, the question you got to ask yourself is, do you feel lucky? So, you know, so we have to balance. And that's where the grid level storage comes in. And so I took that on. And because I know that when I'm done, I'm going to have something that people want, as opposed to just conceiving of cool stuff that, well, what's the purpose?
Right. Yeah. Well, we're going to come back and talk a lot about that. And I love that. That reference really works for me. You made this statement earlier or in another conversation that I loved, which was one of the reasons why you love to invent. You were talking about kind of this idea of innovation, that you love to invent, is because, sort of skipping some of the parts of it, but I can topple a dictator half a world away with the right invention. And you didn't mean it in terms of war. You meant it in terms of freeing human beings. You were talking about water, electrification. We just had one of the lead folks around with World Vision and their project to build water wells and help bring water to human beings in parts of the world, because it's such a horrific problem that a lot of us in the West, just unless we want to make ourselves aware, we're just not aware. And so we talked about that. And I loved your point, which was, look, you need electricity to do the water wells. So we want to join that effort. And in doing that, this is how we improve radically, immediately conditions for human beings in this way. So can you tease out that idea a little bit about inventing to topple and how electricity kind of back to modernity?
Well, the dictator comment was made in the context of what props dictators up. And in many cases, it's petroleum. Mm. And so if we invent technology that moves away from dependence on carbon, mm-hmm. So carbon is no longer a fuel. Carbon becomes a feedstock. Mm-hmm. So we'll still have some petroleum, but we're going to use it as a feedstock for petrochemicals, things like lubricants, and for fabrics. I mean, polymers, all the polymers that we see, the plastic bags, the plastic wrap, the plastic housings on our appliances, that's all petroleum derived. Mm-hmm. So we'll still have that around. But then if the gigantic demand for petroleum collapses, the price of petroleum collapses and dictatorships collapse. Mm-hmm. So that's the connection. And then on the other one, you asked about the water business. Mm-hmm. No question that once we electrify, you take a look at an image of the world at night, and it's a collage because the world is never all dark. Mm-hmm. You know, if it ever were, it's a really bad day for all. Right. Okay, but you can take these NASA images and paste them together, link mm-hmm. them up, and you'll see the way the world looks at night, and you'll see you see the outline mm-hmm. of the continents, and where you see light, you see the modern world, mm-hmm. and where you don't see light is one of two conditions: either nobody lives there, or the place hasn't been electrified. Mm-hmm. And if it hasn't been electrified, there's no more precious gift we can give those people mm-hmm. than access to reliable electricity. Because with electricity, then comes education, water purification. So now you're moving away from just eking out an existence to participating in the modern world. You know, I have colleagues that are really big proponents of massively online courses, and they say, Don, don't you realize, you know, with this MOOC, you know, a poor child in Africa gets access to an MIT lecture series. And I says, the kid doesn't have access to electricity, doesn't have access to the internet.
Right.
You should be worried getting him access to electricity, and then all the other stuff will fall into place.
Yeah. That reminds me of, I did this talk a while ago, and I was comparing industries over the last, I use 50-year segments, so roughly 100 years ago, roughly 50 years ago, and roughly now. And the idea there was, what were the commodities at the turn of the 20th century? What were the big industries in the mid-50s, late 50s? What were the big industries as compared to today? And the point I was trying to make in that conversation was, today the trillion-dollar market cap companies are all data, whether it's cloud, e-commerce, social media, whatever. And so a lot of people make that sort of that point of data is the new oil, and whatever metaphor you want. I would argue that it's attention, that it's not so much data. It's how do I hold your attention? But regardless of that, when I looked at that turn of the century list, one of the largest industries on earth companies was Armour Meatpacking, because they had refrigeration now. We had refrigeration that was moving from ice blocks and ice warehouses eventually into the ice box in the house. We don't even have a concept of that. I don't have a concept of that. And my grandparents were from the Great Depression era. And so it just reminded me of how different it is, you know, not that far ago in our nation's history, we weren't electrified. We weren't electrified across Texas, where a lot of our family's from. We weren't electrified a lot of around the Midwest and more rural areas. And when electricity came in, we used to always think, I remember talking to my grandmother, actually my great-grandmother, was the phone the big thing or the car? She said electricity. That's when it all changed, when you could sleep through the night because you weren't so hot. I was like, oh, you got air conditioning? No, we just got fans. You have no idea what it was like. And so it's such a foreign concept. And as I've heard you talk about it, it's really curious. The last thing, well, anyway, I want to let you react to that before I ask you another question.
Well, there's a lot to react to.
Take your time.
No question that things have changed.
Yeah.
With the information intensity. But it's all based on new technology. Mm. And if I told you not 100 years ago, if I'd even told you 20 years ago that someday you would hold in your hand a device that would allow you to stream wireless information at the rate of a full-length movie, and you would watch it on a screen in ultra high definition held in the palm of your hand, you'd say, I don't believe that. I think Arthur C. Clarke said that a true game-changing invention is indistinguishable from magic.
That's exactly right. Any technology sufficiently advanced. He makes that point. I love that. It's one of my favorite things. I have it on one of my walls around here. He said, to put that in perspective, if you held up your smartphone and gave it to Sir Isaac Newton, he would think it's magic, a genius. They had no concept of colors. They had no concept. I would think it was magic if you were describing this to me 20 years ago and you said all those things. Plus, you said now you can do it from the soccer field while your kid's playing. Like you can watch Stranger Things in high def or the Atlanta Braves game or the Red Sox or whatever, or something from around the world. You know, Manchester United is on your ridiculous device standing out in the field while your children ran and played. Now, there's probably a conversation about paying attention to your kids in there somewhere, but it's, I agree. I completely agree. It's pretty, you know, it used to seem far-fetched. I was trying to make this case to somebody. Are you either a Star Wars or Star Trek fan? Do you pay any attention to any of that? Okay, well, you're missing out, sir. We'll give you an opportunity to catch up. But in the Star Trek series, they have this thing called the holodeck. You walk in to a blank room, you tap your shirt, computer, and it'll make whatever room. And so the illusion's so strong that the walls appear real. You know, it essentially creates a perfect virtual reality digital twin of an environment. And it's real. You can eat. It's like the Matrix. It doesn't seem improbable, certainly not impossible, that at some point, kind of back to our point, in the future, that when we go into our home or whatever, that some version of that is going to exist. I don't know how the science works. I don't know how the math works. Maybe it's not discovered yet, but some version of the holodeck experience in your life where you can come in and say, reshape my house, redo my furniture, I don't know what the energy or materials involved are, but I would never have thought we could do 3D printing from our home. And my friends who are all board gamers 3D print their custom stuff right there in their garage because the chemicals are still too strong. And they just lay out whole new pieces. Like, who does that? That's crazy.
Well, those are all advances in material science.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've said that most of what we have is predicated on the availability of electricity. Mm-hmm. And the other piece of the equation is the advanced materials. I mean, the discovery of the transistor. Mm-hmm. And that, by the way, the transistor that was discovered was germanium. Mm-hmm. And then when people tried to scale it, they took the courageous step to migrate over to silicon. Mm-hmm. Silicon formed a better surface oxide film that protected it and so on. And with the silicon transistor, we have the modern era. Mm-hmm. It's all material science that mm-hmm. advanced that. And, you know, you mentioned earlier about refrigeration and how it changed our supply chain for food and changed our diets. Mm-hmm. I mean, before refrigeration, our diets would be intensively seasonal. Mm-hmm. In the winter, in the Northeast, there's no vegetables, there's no fruits.
That's right.
It's a keto diet.
Yes, it is.
Maybe some grains and stuff, but now we can dial in whatever we want, and from all over the planet.
Right.
And so, if we had storage on the grid, the storage on the grid would do for our electricity supply chain what refrigeration has done for our food supply chain.
I completely agree. We're going to talk about it in a second. One last thing I want to ask you about innovation. You made this really interesting, I thought, compelling point about, the more I thought about it, it's got to be anywhere. When you go to innovate, in fact, you wrote this, I wrote it down about radical innovation. If you want to radically innovate, you're going to have this obstacle called the incumbents, whether it's because they're going to tell you either it can't be done or it shouldn't be done. Or, you know, we need to legislate or something. There is a significant resistance and noise. And when I started to think about that, it reminded me of a previous I don't know if research or whatever, where Henry Ford, when he wanted to distribute his Model Ts, he wanted to do it differently than the established way of dealing. One of the government organizations said, no, you need to go through this dealer network this way. You have to do that. Oh, I remember what it was. I was reading something about Tesla. Tesla cars want to distribute their cars differently than this established dealer infrastructure and kind of norms, and state legislatures were getting involved. I'm probably oversimplifying it, but it was this challenge to the status quo of this 100-year model. Hey, hold on. You can't disrupt this. Why not? I want to be able to bring my product to the marketplace in the most efficient, least expensive manner, benefits to them, benefit to me, and here's how I would do it. And Henry Ford, in a similar way, had run into this when he wanted to distribute his vehicles. And when you were talking about radical innovation, it reminded me of that. So as you've thought about and you've now brought the innovation ideas that you're bringing and the products you're bringing, do you run into that? I'm sure you run into that. What is that? Tease that idea out when you mean radical innovation and how we have to overcome the incumbents.
So in fairness to the incumbents in the areas that I've been working in, metals, looking at, let's take the example of steel. Mm-hmm. That's, by the way, it's a $1 trillion industry. It was 100 years ago, adjusted for inflation, and it is today. In 2019, I'm not going to talk about 2020. That was an aberration. Yeah. Let's just put it that way.
Sure.
But 2019, the world production of steel, and I'm not talking about recycling. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about dirt to metal, mm-hmm. virgin metal, almost 2 billion tons, and that generated about 3.5 billion tons of CO2. Which is, so there's two directions. One is that the 2 billion tons of brand new hot metal at, say, round numbers, $500 a ton, that's $1 trillion industry.
Right.
and then with respect to CO2 emissions, that's almost 10% of CO2. Not 10% of the CO2 that comes from manufacturing. 10% of world CO2 comes from steel making.
Right.
Now, if we put that in context, let's suppose we compare by country, not country steel, just total CO2 by country. Mm-hmm. Number one is China. Mm-hmm. It produces over a quarter of the world CO2. It's about 28%. One country, 28%. Mm-hmm. Number two is USA. Mm-hmm. At about 14.5%. Number three, if it were a country, would be Republic of Steel. Mm. It would be the third largest source of CO2. So you say, what are we going to do about it? Mm-hmm. Well, most of the steel is produced in the blast furnace. That's the way it's been for over 100 years. This is a capital-intensive, risk-averse industry. Mm-hmm. They're not going to turn on a dime. Mm-hmm. And why is it done that way? Because it's the most economic way to do it. Mm-hmm. And so when you want to take on something like that, you have to expect pushback. Mm-hmm. But that's okay. I'm a professor, and I'm open to criticism and mm-hmm. so on. And just make it better and invent a process that makes metal as good, if not better, than the metal that's being made today, cheaper. And then as people look to expand capacity, they will look to this new technology. So you attract them, induce them to adopt. Mm-hmm. You don't condemn them, and you don't force them, and you don't penalize them. They automatically adopt it because it makes sense to do so. Oh yeah, and parenthetically, it doesn't emit CO2.
Right. I completely agree. I love that analogy. In fact, it's I'm not going to go too far off the reservation on this, but just to say, in my own personal life, when I get together with groups of people, and I'm even a member of certain groups of people, that if some other group offends us, let's the go-to low easy move for them is let's boycott somebody, let's protest, let's try to legislate. And there are certainly cases we should legislate. You can't have child labor. We should legislate. All human beings should be treated equal. That's not what I mean. I mean that if my small group is angry at that small group, we're not going to vacation there, or we're going to. And my philosophy has always been, how in any great idea, religious movement, whatever, do you that lasts, you persuade in love, you persuade in this is a better way, you persuade in here's a life that's attractive. When it's authoritative by any means, it generally just becomes that. It becomes authoritative. And, you know, my personal philosophy is you introduce a lot of legislation and a lot of this, it just becomes a hot mess, as opposed to, in most cases, not every case, but let the market decide, look, if I'm making something that's sustainable, and by sustainable, I mean long life. You talk about this a lot. It's economical. It makes sense. It's easy to afford. It's simple to use. And by the way, the benefits are these other to my children and to our legacy and whatever. And the challenge is we'll invent something like that, make something like that, persuade something like that, and consumers will follow it. Our cars look completely different now than they did 50 years ago because we got attracted to the economics and the experience. And I think that's what we're going to continue. Anyway, I said I wouldn't go very long on that, but that's near and dear to my heart. I love your philosophy on that. I just don't know how you win. I don't know how you win people by kind of clubbing them into things. You may force them for a period of time, but you're not going to have lasting change, whether it's in how we relate to each other in the different races or how we invent things for our groups to use. It's got to be in love that's best for the community always.
Well, there are examples where you can have sort of a forcing function to get things moving. California did something along those lines with respect to incandescent light bulbs. Mm-hmm. And so people had to resort to those fluorescents. And mm-hmm. Remember the fluorescents that were, they had the T30 connector. And so you could screw them into the same socket that you would use the old incandescent light mm-hmm. bulb. But they had these very delicate spiral filaments, and mm-hmm. they broke easily. And they gave off this really harsh white light. And people started looking at LEDs. Mm-hmm. And LEDs were frightfully expensive 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And with advances there, the price of LEDs has tumbled to the mm-hmm. point now where you get better light without all of the waste heat. Mm-hmm. And so that was something that was sort of nudged mm-hmm. along. But it wasn't specified. It was mm-hmm. simply said that we want to eliminate this electricity consuming, heat generating form of illumination. Mm-hmm. And you guys figure out what's better than that. And initially it was this ugly fluorescent. And then somebody came along and said,
and they did. And the markets followed it, right? I mean, that's my entire house is LED, my outdoor motion sensing lights, which use a fraction of electricity and are going to last essentially forever, are LED. And so we've improved our quality of life and reduced our costs. And nobody had to force me into getting those things. My wife and my pocketbook forced me into those things. So can we continue on the idea of steel? So I was going to do that after storage, but let's get into it now. So when you came along and you said, look, we can make steel without carbon, can you talk a little bit about, one, why'd you even consider that? I mean, that's kind of a curious thing to do. And if I remember correctly, you'd been thinking about this for a long time. This was not just a quick think. And then, so why did you start? And then can you tell us about that process and how you ended up with creating steel that doesn't emit carbon?
Yeah, so when I first started at MIT, my research area was electrometallurgy. It was electrochemical techniques as applied to metal extraction. So people would be most familiar with aluminum. Aluminum is made by an electrochemical process in which aluminum oxide it's the feedstock. Mm-hmm. Aluminum oxide is dissolved in a solvent at around 1,000 degrees centigrade. And that solvent is a salt, but it's not a salt solution in water. It's a salt that's been heated to the point that salt has melted. So the salt is now a liquid. We mm-hmm. call it molten salts. And the aluminum oxide dissolves in this molten salt. It's a fluoride. And by the action of electric current, two electrodes cross this soup of aluminum oxide and molten fluoride. By the action of electric current, we decompose aluminum oxide. And at one electrode, we make liquid aluminum. Mm. And at the other electrode, it's a carbon electrode. We make the oxygen from the aluminum oxide comes off and we make carbon dioxide. Mm. And that got me thinking about, well, why don't we get rid of the carbon anode and replace it with something that will evolve oxygen instead of CO2? And that was sort of the point of departure. And I did a lot of research in the area of aluminum extraction, but all the reactive metals are produced by this electrolytic type of process. Aluminum, magnesium, lithium, sodium, calcium, all these metals, the rare earths, if you want to go to rare earth metals, not the rare earth oxides, they're all produced by these electrolytic techniques. Mm-hmm. And along the way, one day I was thinking about, well, you can't just replace the electrode. You have to do a holistic makeover, and you should change the composition of the solvent as well. Why are we dissolving an oxide in a fluoride? I mean, for many years I've been teaching this big chemistry class at MIT, and it's general chemistry, mm-hmm. first introductory gen chem class, and one of the units is on solution, solubility, and so on. And the aphorism is, like dissolves like. So if I've got an oxide, why am I not dissolving it in a molten oxide? And everybody said, you're crazy. You're going up in temperature? Yeah, I'm going to go up in temperature. And they said, well, but that's too hot. How are you going to contain it? And I said, well, we'll just have a thermal gradient, and we'll have it cold at the wall, and you'll have molten oxide contained in frozen oxide. It'll be contained in the skull of itself. He said, you're crazy. And I just kept going and going and going. And back in the 80s, electricity was viewed as too precious a form of energy. No way you could make metal as cheap as steel using as precious a reducing agent as the electron. Well, what's happened over time? The price of electricity in converted currency, not in absolute numbers, but in effective purchasing power, price of electricity is going down. Mm-hmm. And now, for the first time, I'm looking at it saying, hey, if I put a smelter up in Quebec and I get electricity for 1.5 cents a kilowatt hour, you can bet I'll make you steel at a price point that's competitive with the best steel that's being produced by the conventional technology. So it's being able to imagine, you know, the Bobby Kennedy had that line about some people look at the world and ask why, mm-hmm. and others imagine mm-hmm. a world and ask why not. Well, I'm in that second category. Mm-hmm. And Theodore von Karman said that the scientist discovers that which exists. The engineer creates that which never was.
My dad, who's an engineer, absolutely loves that. Absolutely. It kind of, I was Army, and, you know, in the military, we love to pick on each other. So if you bump into somebody that's highly regarded, but they're in a different military branch, you like to tease them about, you know, Navy, Marine, Army. We all grudgingly admit we are all in the military. But when we bump into people in the Air Force, it's harder for us to acknowledge that they're actually in the military until we need their planes to move us somewhere or to save our butts and get us out of somewhere or stop. But I love that. So your engineer scientist funny tension there is kind of like Star Trek and Star Wars. But anyway, conversation for another day. So when you By the way, I think I'm going to put your number in my phone, and your ringtone's going to be "You're Crazy." I love that. Professor Sadoway, you're crazy. How it couldn't have been just when you started. I guess maybe I want to ask the question this way. At what point did you get momentum of people saying, wow, that makes a lot of sense? Not just your sort of the academics there in the lab, but industry, investors. I mean, the idea went from a little idea to a big idea with a lot of credibility. Was it just the combination of the economics now made it to where it's not just going to do it on a small scale in a lab? Or what and when was the time frame where you really began getting momentum around that idea of creating steel using electricity?
I think that it was really a confluence of myself, mm-hmm. who is an inventor and has this idea, and then an investor. And it was an investor who was ahead of his time. It was just a Forrest Gump moment. Mm-hmm. I just happened to be giving a talk at a symposium in honor of a professor. And I talked about this concept of making steel by molten oxide electrolysis. And out of the audience, this man approaches me. Mm-hmm. And he made some money in geology and exploring minerals, processing, and so on. And he said, let's go for a coffee. And then coffee became dinner. And finally he says, well, what would it take to try to make an industrial representation of it? Mm-hmm. And so I blurted out a number, and he said, okay, let's go. And so that's how it started. And so in 2012, we formed what at that time was called Boston Electrometallurgical. Mm-hmm. We've since rebranded it as Boston Metal because, except for a few people, no one could pronounce electrometallurgical, and no one could spell it, and no one would know what it meant.
Right.
So it was a terrible name.
Right.
So it started with that, and then as we de-risked it and started to build something that's not a science project, right, but something that looks like an industrial reactor, people went, this thing just might work. Yeah. And then came the realization, you know, but even going back to 2012, the imperative to decarbonize on a massive scale, it still wasn't there.
Right.
People were talking about tailpipe emissions, but the notion that, do you realize if we electrify every car, the impact it makes on CO2 emissions is nothing in comparison with what is needed to abate steel.
Right.
CO2 emissions from steel. So all of a sudden, over time, people start looking at, well, where else does CO2 come from? And then they get this hit list. And all of a sudden, you mean you can make steel without CO2 emissions? Tell us more. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I had to be working on this for a long time.
Yeah. And you make this point. It's not just you can make it without emissions. To your point in the beginning of our conversation, I'm sure you'll make it again when we talk about energy storage, affordable steel. It's affordable. It's high quality. It's readily available. It solves these problems. You talk, not to steal any of your thunder, but I love how you, when you talk to your students, because you work with a lot of postdoc and other students, look, here's the task ahead of us, but here's your parameters. In the military, whenever we go to do a job, when I was in the military, it was, here's the deal. You have to work between the Geneva Convention and the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and you have to be about mission accomplishment and troop welfare. Here's your box. Now go to the box, and you lay out all the time, look, this is what we're trying to do, but here's our box. It can't be so cost effective, it doesn't work. It can't be, nobody will buy it, or costly, nobody will buy it. It can't be so hard to maintain, people can't simply operate it. And it can't defeat the purpose of, well, hey, let's go get the material from across the world to bring it over here so the supply chain screwed up. Our, you know, at the end of the day, it has to work within these boundaries. Go do it. And you've done it twice. I think it's amazing when the universe finds people like you that sit there and scratch their head. I think there's a book out there. I haven't read it yet, called The Art of the Possible. What if? Huh. You're crazy. And you kind of crazy your way into all of these amazing things. So do you think, I mean, is there a, so now we're at this trajectory. Wow, we can impact 9 to 10% of the global carbon emission industry in a way that's economical. Are the incumbents still resisting, or are they embracing it?
We're starting to see motion from the incumbents. Mm. They want to reduce their carbon emissions, but they have to do so also. They have their box.
Sure.
They can't take a wrecking ball to all of their blast furnaces today.
Right.
And the second thing is that, of course, the electrons have to be generated right. with zero carbon emissions.
Right.
Many of the steel plants are sited where electricity is produced by burning coal. So you're not going to get anywhere by replacing the blast furnace with electrolytic technology if you're getting your electrons by burning coal. So,
right.
yeah, but people are mindful of the need to reduce CO2 emissions, and you're starting to see incumbents lining up with it.
One of your
still have a ways to go, but
yeah,
a lot has changed even in the last 5 years.
One of the coolest things, and I'll bet all of the people who love you, and I find myself in that category, love this perspective. A boss of mine said once, look, McCall, our goal is paradise. We want to get from here to paradise, but we got to eat on the way to paradise. And how I reference that to you is, as I've heard you speak many, many times, look, the goal, paradise, looks like we've reduced, whether we're carbon zero or not, we've reduced carbon such that human beings are not making a significant, a measurable impact to the planet. That's our goal, is something that looks like this. But we've got to eat on the way. Should we go out and wreck the fossil fuel infrastructure today? Well, not necessarily. If it causes more harm than good on the way, we should take advantage of when we have growth. Well, let's see if we can grow with a renewable, nuke, smart green, whatever. Depending upon the geography, is there hydro available? Is there wind that's available? Is there solar that's available? Is there nuke that's available? How do we do that as we expand the grid? And two, when things reach their end of life and it's time to decommission them, how do we decommission them in a smart way and replace it with something? That seems to be me. Let the people who are in that industry, because the momentum is we're moving to reducing or eliminating carbon emission to the best of our ability. Give them an opportunity not to wreck their industry and wreck their business, but to adopt and change. That seems to me to be a pretty reasonable approach.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. Give them a roadmap give them the assurance that they're still going to be in business. There will be some exceptional cases where people don't make the change, and in some of those industries, disruption comes from not within the industry, but from outside the industry. It comes from new players.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine being somebody that is producing the world's best vacuum tubes, and you just built a brand new vacuum tube manufacturing facility in 1954? And along comes this solid state silicon transistor, and you're saying that.
Right.
So at some point, this is what will happen. And I can tell you that in the battery industry, lithium ion batteries, really the first producer of lithium ion battery was Sony.
Mm.
Sony in the 1980s. Was not involved in entertainment. Sony was building televisions. They were building handheld devices. They had the Walkman. If you recall.
Yeah, the camcorder, the Walkman, yeah.
The Walkman, the only reason the Walkman existed was that we had invented neodymium iron boron magnet, which meant that you could have headphones that weren't plugged into a refrigerator. Mm-hmm. Because if you were in the 1970s, your headphones had to be plugged into your stereo amplifier.
Right.
But with the neodymium iron boron magnet, you could walk and be playing an audio cassette and so on. And then Sony came out with a handheld camera. The cameras in the early 80s, my kids were small.
Yeah.
I had a VHS camera. It was a big monster. It had to go up on the shoulder, and it had the transport mechanism and the video recording apparatus. And then I had a second big heavy thing, and that was strapped and it was on my hip.
That's right.
And that was the battery.
Yeah.
Together. Well, Sony by 1990 had something that in one little box had the CCD and a magnetic card, magnetic drive.
Right.
And it was handheld. They called it Handycam.
Right.
They wanted a longer runtime. All of rechargeables were nickel metal hydride at that time.
Right.
And there was a person at one of their suppliers. He was one of the three winners of the Nobel Prize 2 years ago for the lithium ion battery. Yoshino is his name. And he had seen the work that Goodenough and Whitting had done, but they had this lithium metal, which was shorting out the battery with dendrites. And he came up with the idea of using the carbon as a host, and he put that together, and he had the very first lithium ion battery. And Sony went to the big battery producers in Japan and said, look at this new chemistry. Build this for us. And they got a purchase order for some tens of millions of dollars, whatever it was. And every one of those battery producers said, no. I said, what? I said, we have all our capital investment in nickel metal hydride. We're not building it.
Mm-hmm.
So Sony, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall at that board meeting. Somebody had to have suggested the audacity of Sony. Well, there's only one way we're going to get lithium-ion battery. We're going to have to build it ourselves.
Yeah.
And they built the first facility. And by 19, what was happening in the early 90s? That was the ascendancy of the laptop computer.
That's right.
Because the laptop was only enabled by the nickel metal hydride battery. You could have built a laptop in 1985, but with a lead acid battery, it only run for less than an hour, wouldn't have been worth the trip.
Right.
But so now you could go even better, about 50% longer runtime. So all of the guys who are buying nickel metal hydride batteries say, cancel that order. Let's get some of those lithium ions. What else was coming online in the early 90s? The handheld phone, mobile phone. And all those people said, forget the nickel metal, let's get the thing. So by 1995, lithium ion had displaced nickel metal hydride. What's the lesson there? The lesson is that in that industry, disruption came from outside the industry, not from within the industry. So where do you think disruption is going to come from today? What do you think is going to disrupt lithium ion? You think it's going to come from within the lithium ion industry?
Yeah, no.
We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
I love that.
Watch what's coming out of my lab.
I wish you were more passionate. That's the thing. I wish you were more passionate. I love that. And you reminded me, when you're telling me that story, one that popped in my head, I'm sure you know this, is the story of Xerox and creating email and the local area network and all these other things in the Bay Area and their little research group. And the guys back in New York or whatever said, that'll never, can that thing. And this guy, Jobs, he and his buddy ran back to their garage and said, completely out of the industry, had nothing to do with it. And, and it took it's almost a generational thing, a generation of innovators, Gates and Jobs, the way that they were frenemies so many times and, these corporations that were driven and smart and capable, but they came from outside of, and you see that in social media startups and other things where every now and then I hear whoever the old timer is, I think I'm entering into the age of the old timer, but like, man, when are we going to have our next genius songwriters or our next genius innovators or our next just give them a moment. Give that generation a moment, and entrepreneurs are going to step up, and they're going to weigh that we didn't see coming. Although when you mentioned the Walkman, the only thing I could remember is when we got all the Walkmans in our neighborhood, the other side industry that boomed were the headbands, because you couldn't keep your headphones on without your headbands. And so it became kind of a side thing. Yeah, I probably shouldn't confess that too much. That's all right. So steel, innovation. One of the things, as I said in the beginning of this, it's really near and dear to my heart. Maybe someday I'll have you back on. I've got another guest coming on to talk about e-waste, which is a related but separate category that I wrote on last year, and I'm researching, because we're talking about we're going to talk about energy storage here in just a second. But as we talk about all these things, and you've mentioned materials, you know, there are, I'm also starting to become aware of people who talk about, man, you know, there's a finite amount of materials in the world and how we go get them. And now should we do undersea mining? And so it's just introducing conversations to me about how do we, going forward in the pursuit of whatever we're doing, not lose the lesson of carbon, because it's not just about carbon, decreasing carbon emission. It is about, how do we help human beings flourish? Like, how do we do that? How do we have a healthy environment for us to flourish in? So he's coming on. Maybe someday, if you're interested, we could talk about that. But as we move into energy storage, Professor Kamen, who runs, I know I'm going to get the name of his lab wrong, but energy, smart, renewable, sustainable or energy lab out of Berkeley, and I were talking, he's been on the show a couple times now. And he introduced the idea to me, which you've so elegantly expanded on for me, which is there isn't sustainable energy without energy storage. Now, what he and I did not get into, he just introduced the concept of it. What we didn't get into was grid level energy storage. We talked about some of the emerging technologies. But if you could talk about why energy storage is so important, number one, and then what I'm interested in, and I think our audience is really interested in, is not so much why we need energy storage for mobile and small devices, but if you were to try to scale that up, especially, I look at my facility, sir, of, you know, like I said before, hundreds of megawatts of capacity. Most of my customers, or many of my customers, are the largest buyers and consumers of IT infrastructure. And to their credit, they're driving a lot of the conversation about renewable and sustainable and having a plan and putting governance around it and being audited. And we're full-on partners with them. There's great work. But there is more work to be done, I think, in storage in general. And then how it relates to big industry like data centers or airports or whatever without making bombs, and that's affordable and whatever. So can you talk about how you got into energy storage and then just that path down to the battery technology that you invented?
Sure. So when you start thinking about grid level storage, let's look at something like the data center, mm-hmm. which is a huge consumer of electric power, mm-hmm. And let's say they want to become green, mm-hmm. and so let's say they connect to electric generation by say solar. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens when the sun doesn't shine? So you need storage to bridge the gap. What happens when the wind doesn't blow and you're connected to wind generated electric facility? Mm-hmm. These intermittent renewables can't be fully integrated into base load because they don't operate 24/7.
Right.
So storage is the missing piece. Storage allows you to draw electricity from the sun even when the sun doesn't shine. Mm-hmm. And that's a powerful idea. But the alternative isn't appealing at all. Mm-hmm. If I told you I'd give you electricity for free 12 hours a day, but I won't tell you which 12 hours, what are you going to do with that? You know, so you have to have it, but it also makes things more resilient because there will be outages. And you mentioned Texas earlier in our conversation. Mm-hmm. Texas had some mishap this past winter, and with storage, long duration storage, they could ride that out. Obviously, they had to do some other things, like firm up the gas lines and so on and so forth. But there will be outages. Mm-hmm. So storage is critical in bringing carbon-free renewables online. And also, there are other examples of where storage can play a role. I give an example of Manhattan, where because of Wall Street becoming very, very information intensive, the electricity consumption is going up, even though the population is pretty much the same, about 8 million people, and has been for a long time. So you say, well, so you just the middle of a August hot day, the demand on electricity in Manhattan exceeds the capacity of the transmission lines. There's plenty of generation of electricity in the New York area, but not on the island of Manhattan. It comes by a transmission line. So you say, well, we'll just put in more transmission lines. Well, this is hundreds of millions of dollars for a transmission line.
Right.
Well, if you had batteries, in the basements of all of those tall buildings, then you could be charging those batteries in the wee hours of the morning when demand is low and there's no congestion on the transmission network. And then in the middle of the afternoon when demand is high, you're pulling electricity out of your sub-basement. And so that's peak shaving. And so as a result, you've deferred the need to install the transmission lines. And so storage has there's a plurality of functions that it can play in making the grid more resilient, more efficient, and keeping our costs down. So it's the Rodney Dangerfield of technology, and it doesn't get any respect. You know, this is storage. If you want to see a quenching effect, if I walk into a cocktail party. And somebody says, so what are you working on? I say, steel. That's a big deflator.
Right.
Hey, did you see the Red Sox? Right. You know, no one's talking about steel.
Right.
All right. So what are you working on? Grid level storage. There are no follow up questions.
Right.
but it's pervasive.
Right.
We've got to have it.
Yeah, you know, it's for the reasons that you stated. Also, in the data center industry, the grid fails on occasion. I mean, I mean there are times when the there are swags and sags in delivery. As we know, when we have big electrical, we've got anywhere from 115,000 volt up to 200,000 plus volt high voltage transmission lines coming in that we have to step down and make into medium voltage and then the low voltage so we can bring to the floor. And we bring them through energy storage infrastructure, one, to kind of clean them up. And two, we put the storage in between the IT gear and the grid because we know that grid, whether it's a brownout, whether it's a renewable energy source that's going to have moments, whether it's whatever, there's complex. Somebody hits the pole up there. Now, almost all of ours are tied directly to a substation, usually in almost every case, if not every case, in highly redundant manner. But still, there's the risk, and we have to go through storage. What was intriguing to me. And we use typical, in some cases, lithium ion, in some cases, lead acid. But if you're talking about grid level, not just my data center, but grid level massive storage in a way, for all the reasons that you and I have stated here, what caught my attention was, first of all, the technology that you invented. And secondly, why would you even think about inventing something like that? I kind of get the steel because of your... You know, what your interest was as a young professor at MIT and, you know, where you went with that. But what was the idea that, so now you recognize that storage is interesting, and then how you went on this journey?
Well, it starts with the recognition that there's this unmet need. Okay. I mean, I got into storage quite by accident. I was teaching a class was in technology and policy, and I was conscripted to give some lectures on batteries because they were about 32 students, and they were doing a group. They were divided into four groups of eight, so each of these teams had the challenge of working for a semester on the problem: improve air quality in the Los Angeles basin. Mm-hmm. That was it, open ended. So they could do anything, you know, government forcing, penalties, incentives, and so on. And somebody thought, this was 1994. Mm-hmm. Somebody thought that, well, electric cars might be part of the solution. And so they said, find somebody who can talk about batteries, because that's probably going to be batteries involved. So they called me up and said, would you give us some lectures on batteries? So I wasn't working on batteries at the time, and I looked at the field and I said, this is primitive. Mm. Man, there's room here. Anyways, we got an invitation to go out to Ford. And so four of us go out, and we spent a day at Ford, and they had built an electric car back in 1994.
Wow. Right.
Powered by a sodium sulfur battery. And they allowed us to take this on an open road. And I got in that car, and I'm zooming down the interstate, and it was fantastic. Because I grew up in Oshawa, Ontario. I love cars.
Right.
But, you know, by the 1990s, all the cars, they all looked like they came out of the same CAD-CAM program.
Right.
They were boring.
Right.
They were horrible. I mean, driving the car was, there was no thrill.
Right.
But this thing here had neck-snapping acceleration, and it was fantastic. I got back to Boston. And I look in the mirror and I said, you know, there's only one reason we don't have an electric car. It's the battery. And you're an electrochemist, so why don't you do something about it? So that's how I started working on batteries, because I wanted to help to figure out how to make an affordable electric car. And I did make some initial inventions in the 90s, and lithium metal and solid polymer and all this other stuff. But then around 2005, a colleague came in to me and he says, I just came back from a planning meeting on the MIT Energy Initiative, and we're looking at grand challenges, and one of them is grid level storage. I mean, lithium ion is just not correct. But in 2005, lithium ion was priced at $2,000 a kilowatt hour.
Wow.
So
yeah,
today it's at the cell level, it's probably closer to $125, something like that.
Right.
But it was 2000, which was prohibitive.
Right.
It was impossibly expensive. So I said, well, that sounds like a challenge. Mm-hmm. And my colleague says to me, he says, you know, you've been doing all this work in high temperature electrochemistry, metallurgy, and so on. You think you've learned anything in that area that mm-hmm. might be relevant to stationary storage? Mm. And he left my office. And I started thinking about it. I said, yeah, maybe there is. And so because I'd worked in this very exotic sort of niche zone of electrochemistry, metallurgy, and so on, I was familiar with liquid metals, with molten salts, and so on. And as a result, I conceived of this liquid metal battery. Mm-hmm. And after that, the rest is history.
Well, tell us about the history. So as I've heard you speak, it's so entertaining when you lay out the parameters to the folks that you work with. Look, here's our big ideas. Here's our big goal. Go. So tell us about that process.
So the liquid metal battery has, as every battery has, get two electrodes and an electrolyte. And so the electrodes in the liquid metal battery are both the metals that are above their melting point. Mm-hmm. And the electrolyte is not an aqueous solution because water boils at 100 degrees centigrade. We're going up to 400 or 500. And so it's a salt that's melted as opposed to a salt dissolved in water. Mm-hmm. And the metal doesn't dissolve in the salt, and the salt doesn't dissolve in the metal. So you have three layers. They lie on top of one another like salad oil and vinegar, only instead of two layers, you get three layers. And that's the basis of the battery. But I was also thinking about scalability and cost. And so I coined this idea of cost-informed discovery. Mm. What that means is you think about cost on day one, not day 1001. Because the model of research at the university goes something like this: invent the coolest chemistry, and then, you know, maybe somebody wants to take that and start a company, and then let the scaling people chase down the cost curve. And I say, yeah, you can do that, but it's not going to work in this sector because you're up against incumbents. The incumbents are fossil fuels, which are heavily subsidized and deeply entrenched. So I've got to invent below the price point of fossil fuel. And so that means I've got to think about cost on day one. So first thing I said is I look at the periodic table and I just take a big swath of it and tell my people, you're forbidden to go here. Because anything that's here, I don't care if it makes a great battery. Suppose someone says, oh, what about tellurium? Well, tellurium, I know I can make a beautiful battery with lithium and tellurium, except tellurium is about as earth abundant as gold. So it's not going to scale. Right. So forget it. I say, if you want to make something dirt cheap, you make it out of dirt, and preferably dirt that's locally sourced. That way you have a secure supply chain. It doesn't make sense to replace your dependence on imported petroleum for dependence on imported neodymium, and that's what we have.
Right.
We get all of our rare earths from China. Well, you know, we got to do better than that. So we look at the periodic table and we say, these are the elements that are broadly available. They're dirt cheap. They're ethically sourced. They could be recycled, and on and on and on. And pretty soon, it's very clear what you're going to build your things out of.
Right. And one of your discussions, you said, and I had this really smart person helping me, and they wanted a PhD. And so, go. That was amusing as you turn them loose. So, what's been the experience now that you've invented the liquid metal battery? Is industry embracing it? What's the reaction to it?
So let's preface this by saying, so we started the company, I with two of my students. We started the company, and it was started about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's been 10 years mm-hmm. of really hard work to master how to build this thing at scale. So we discovered that the battery works even better than we had imagined in terms of electrochemistry. But what we weren't prepared for is the inventing the manufacturing process. And so it's been, because no one is going to put a battery on the grid unless it has been demonstrated to be reliable. And some people are so conservative, they're going to say, you tell me that this thing will go for 10 years and it will still retain charge. I want to see the data. Okay, so all I got to do is I better get started this afternoon because I've got to give this guy 10 years of data. So this is the how high the bar is raised. Mm-hmm. They want no hiccups.
Right.
And so the company is now in its 11th year and has done a magnificent job of grappling with some seemingly insurmountable barriers that had to do with the manufacturing, things like high temperature seals, and being able to reliably manufacture and so on. And they've mastered all of that. Mm-hmm. And now they've got an order book that's populating. And one of the first customers, as you'd be happy to know, is a data center. And they understand that for this massive, you know, we're talking hundreds of megawatt hours mm-hmm. Storage capacity, that lithium ion is not the smart technological choice, and they're going to go with liquid metal. And I think that people want to go with something that they're familiar with. So mm-hmm. they will incorrectly go with lithium ion because it's there. But I like to say in something that involves a big change, nobody wants to be first. Mm. Everybody wants to be first to be second.
Right.
And once it's demonstrated to work with somebody else who took the risk, then everybody else goes, yeah, I knew that.
Right.
I knew it would work.
Well, there's, you know, true. Here's one of the cool things, especially at the hyperscale level in data centers. Usually most data center operators are fast followers. We're not always the early adopters, but those that are going to be successful and remain were fast followers. And in particular, when your customers are one of these, you know, big 5, 10, 12 trillion dollar market cap companies that start with A and G and F and, you know, et cetera. And those folks, in some cases, some smaller cases, are early adopters, and they will, in their own personal only, you know, they build for themselves, their own capacity, and they also outsource. And so they will innovate in the areas of robotics. They will innovate. They'll take lessons that they've learned in their big warehouses of materials handling, and they will share it with us, pretty closely guarded, but they'll share it with us because they want us to be good partners and come along. Now, in most cases, Professor Sadoway, if I went to one of those big organizations and said, hey, I want to wholesale replace, I don't know, maybe some of my kinetic ride through diesel gens or whatever, there is still enough mix of people in these organizations that are risk adverse to say, wait a minute, we've rode through, we've had storage that's looked like whatever for generations. We don't want you to just go from, you know, from that model to this model. In our world, that used to, all of the data centers used to be a thing called 2N. I'm sure you're familiar with 2N. If I need one of everything to deliver a product or service to remain up, 2N was more of a military thing at the time. Give me two. So not a spare tire, four spare tires. I need one for everything. And so usually that just meant in the electrical mechanical infrastructure, but in some cases it's double everything. Well, that's long gone. The economics has forced us past that more than a decade ago. We used to say, you know, people would come to us even 10, 12 years ago and say, man, we'd really like your data centers to have a green energy component. Sure, I can get it from the grid, but it's five times as expensive. Well, now it's equal to or less than. And so it's not we'd like you to have, it's if you don't have and have a path and have board that buys into it and executive officers that buy into it and governance, we're not doing business. And so they usually, what will happen in our world, and I love this about them, is we're going to develop an experiment. We want you to join us and kind of help figure it out. And once we got it nailed down, this is what we expect part of your design to be, especially now that we're, who would have imagined in my industry 5 years ago, a campus for data center infrastructure that has to, that is going to accomplish these things. One, it has to be sustainable. They want to see how that's going to work. One, it's got to be part of the community. There's got to be social initiatives. It can't just be this big gray looking building over there. Three, it's got to be easily operated by local people. And now, when you create storage, we don't want you to make a bomb. We want you to make, you know, it's got, and it's this much capacity. It's, you know, thousands of megawatts, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of megawatts, if not more than 1,000 megawatts. We just couldn't conceive of that even 10 years ago. If those people who said they can, no, they couldn't. And we were talking about edge data centers, but right now most data centers go to where the eyeballs are and where latency allows us to get to. And so we're probably not going to build in the middle of a Omaha prairie yet. They'll eventually get there. But right now it's, you know, how do I deliver this? So it's this really cool interconnected ecosystem, but there is no doubt in my mind that that's going to happen. And then by extending what we would consider grid level storage to data centers and our data center infrastructure, the second part of it is extends it to the entire grid, to the grid that's not necessarily the data center. It's the rural grid. It's the urban grid. It's all of these grid areas. So I think it's a great path. But I am curious, when you think about this, what how big are the batteries? How big? Like, I have a concept in my head because I know how big my UPS battery rooms are in my data centers that are, they're probably at, I don't know, 120 megawatts today, almost all. Well, it depends on the data center and where we are in our technology cycle for them. Kind of what we talked about before. If I deployed infrastructure 5 years ago on VRLA batteries or 10 years ago, I'm not going to go throw that all away until it's reached its end of its life cycle. And then I'm going to rotate it out for whatever comes next. We have lithium ion, pretty common in the data center industry, up to a certain size. So as we're looking at the next thing, and there are other energy sources, if I'm, you know, what are the sizes of the batteries? What are the containers they come in? What does that look like as you scale it up?
So you can think of it as multiples of a 40-foot shipping container.
Okay.
And the 40-foot shipping container would be on the decade from 1 to 10 megawatt hours.
Oh, okay.
So you have, you're stacking them side by side.
Right.
And, you have roughly what you see in lithium ion. Mm-hmm. That would be sort of the norm. Mm-hmm. Only in our case with liquid metal, we don't have to have the cooling system and so on because they operate at elevated temperature.
Right.
But that's how to think about it.
One of the conversations I've heard you talk about was peak loads on the grid. And how, when you know, it's not just energy storage, it's not just sustainable energy, but how do we think about the grid infrastructure that we build? Can you talk about that idea so people can understand, one, how do we build grids today, and how should we think about building a grid if we're building this whole ecosystem?
So in order to handle the changes in demand, remember, let's predicate this by reminding ourselves that the grid operates such that supply must equal demand everywhere at all times. Mm-hmm. So when the demand goes up, you ramp up your generation capacity. And when the demand goes down, you trim it back. Now, coal-fired plant, gas-fired plant, they respond very nicely to that. You can turn them all the way back to zero, do a black start. You can turn them, push them all the way up, and you design them so that at full capacity, they can more than meet the extreme high demand. Mm-hmm. Nuclear reactor can't vary over such a wide range. Mm-hmm. But you peg the nuclear reactor so that it can more than meet the peak demand. But when the demand goes way, way down, it can't trim back. If you try to trim it back too much, the nuclear reaction will stop.
Right.
So what do you do? Now you've got supply exceeding demand. It's 2 a.m. and the demand is way down, but the nuclear reactor is still producing.
Right.
So that's where the batteries come in. So you slough that off into the batteries. And the batteries become integrated into the supply-demand balancing act. But going farther with this, imagine a situation where many people have their own source of electricity, either wind or solar. Well, imagine a grid where we put storage at the load center so that we put storage not by the generation facility, but where the demand is. Mm. And so that means if every home had something about the size of, let's say, a 25 cubic foot refrigerator, mm-hmm. and that would hold, say, 100 kilowatt hours. Typical American home consumes about 10 kilowatt hours a day of electricity. That could be 10 days of runtime in the worst situation. So now you have a distributed system. And so that gives you more resilience, because if somebody takes down a central generating facility, you have all of this distributed storage and all of those. Now you have to start thinking about things that no one had planned for the original grid, which is making transmission of electricity bi-directional. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks it starts from the center and it goes in one direction to mm-hmm. your house. Mm-hmm. But now I'm saying, well, what if it's after a storm or something and you're still generating on your roof? well, why can't you be sending electricity out and powering your neighbors and so on and so forth? So next generation grid, I can see much more distributed. But the only way that thing's going to work is you have to have distributed storage. And so that's still an unmet need, sort of single family home, small to medium enterprise size, say tens of kilowatt hours, 100, 200, 300 kilowatt hours, battery for that size. So I'm working on that.
I was just about to ask if that's available, because I can hear, so I live down in the Atlanta area, and I have a number of friends who are unlikely joiners to this conversation, but they love the idea and have come around to the idea of energy independence for a variety of reasons. I'm not going to get into all the reasons, but they love the idea of having solar or whatever. They're generating their own electricity. Their failover is to go to the grid if something were to happen to their alternative input. But really what they'd like is what you just described. Hey, if I had this refrigerator-sized something and I can put it in my shed, I could put it in my garage, I could put it whatever, it's out of the way. I don't feel that it's unsafe. It's long-lasting. It's simple to install. And it can give me the ride through. We don't have big storms here. We have moderate sort of tail ends of hurricanes will come through. But on occasion, we get ice. Probably about every 3 years, we're knocked offline. And when that happens, as you know, there in Boston, Boston can't recover from a snowstorm like they can in Canada. They think they can, but they can't clear those streets as quick and whatever. Unlike those Canadians. Well, down here, when we have a big storm, we have lots of tall pines, a lot of infrastructure goes down. It can take 3 to 5 days. And I've got my freezer full of stuff. I would love to have days of ride through. So I think that'd be an amazing solution. Last question before we wrap up, or one of the last questions. What's got you excited about not just in energy storage or even in manufacturing, just in material science? What are some of the ideas that are really tickling your brain, maybe that you haven't tackled yet, or you're just hearing and like, this is going to be a great next thing that's to come?
Well, I'll give you some wild ones. Some of these I don't even work on.
Sure.
But someone said, well, we're going to make you Secretary of Energy. How would you
right.
direct research budget? And I would make some changes. So you talked earlier about the high voltage transmission line.
Yes, sir.
So you remember from high school, if someone holds up an orange and shines a flashlight on it, what half of the orange is bright and the other half is in shadow.
Right.
And that's a metaphor. That's the way the world works.
Mm-hmm.
Half of it is illuminated by the sun and half of it is dark.
Right.
So how do we draw electricity from the sun when the sun doesn't shine? We have storage, and that's something that I've been working on. But there's another way we could do that. We could, if we had transmission lines that would transmit electricity anywhere on the globe at all times, but with no loss.
Mm-hmm.
See, if you go long distance, the line itself is a resistor.
Right.
It takes energy to move the electron down the line. Just as, the tanker truck, when it's going down the highway.
Right.
I don't know if people realize this, but it is also burning fuel.
That's
because they have to power the truck as
That's
well.
Right. That's right.
And can you imagine if the truck to go from the depot to the customer burned almost all the fuel that's in the tank just to power the truck, then that becomes kind of a pointless exercise.
Right.
Well, so how do we send electricity thousands of miles? How do we do that? Thousands of miles with no loss. Room temperature superconductivity. Why are we working on that? If I could give you superconducting wires that operate at room temperature, not at liquid nitrogen temperature, then you can put your solar panels where you've got high intensity, and then be sending that electricity all over, and then 12 hours later, that's in darkness, and you could be bringing it in the other direction. So that's a wild idea. But here's another one, and this is that's a material science, mm-hmm. purity. But here's another one that's electrochemistry, because I'm an electrochemist. Everything has to be done electrochemically.
Right.
And non-aqueous. But
okay.
I don't, you know, water's fine for cooking and stuff and bathing.
Right.
Serious electrochemistry doesn't occur in water. So let's go to the foreseeable future. Foreseeable future, we will still be burning fossil fuel. Mm-hmm. We cannot all of a sudden, as of midnight tonight, say, no more fossil fuel. That means we're going to be without electricity because we don't have enough from renewables, from hydro, from nuclear. So suppose I developed an electrochemical technique that destroys CO2 before it goes up the stack. So I call it the zapper, the CO2 zapper. So now I could then burn coal to get the thermal value out of the coal without sending CO2 into the atmosphere. So now it's going to take energy, but that energy could be coming from the sun. And so I think that's something worth pursuing. I mean, there are some people that are trying to, they call it DAC, direct air capture. They're already trying to get the CO2 out of the air. Mm-hmm. But the CO2 is only 415 parts per million. Mm-hmm. So that means you're going to go through a million molecules of oxygen and nitrogen to find the 415 CO2s. Man, that's
a lot of work.
That makes needle in a haystack look like a sure bet, you know? It's really, really thick. Let's get it before it leaves.
Right.
Right? You know, you remember, you know, when I was in college, there used to be an ashtray at every seat in the auditorium.
Yeah.
The professors smoked, the students smoked, and so on. And then eventually it became, it's not cool to smoke anymore. Right. They took away all the ashtrays and so on. And then they forbid the smoking in the buildings and so on. And I was thinking, the issue is not whether you smoke or not. The issue is whether your smoke affects your neighbor. So I said, you can smoke, you just can't exhale. And so you can burn coal, you just can't vent the CO2. Now, some people are trapping it. They have they call it CCS, carbon capture and storage. And that's good. It prevents the CO2 from going in the atmosphere, but there's only so much storage. I mean, you got to put this into caverns and so on. And then eventually, I mean, it's sitting there.
Right.
You know, we got to get rid of it. So eventually we have to destroy it. But I think those are two ideas that are worth pursuing.
Well, I think they are as well. I have so been edified, not just by our conversation today, but you've been in my head for a few weeks now, off and on, and I really enjoy it. I don't. Do you have five more minutes? Because I have not so much a question, but I would love for you to tell a brief story that you tell so beautifully. Would that be okay?
You go ahead and ask me.
So it was one of the things that you talked about, and I just chuckled and chuckled and chuckled. I was so amused. My wife came over to see what it was that I was amused by. So I rewound and I played again for her your explanation of how you came to get your angel investor for the liquid metal idea once you were ready to take it to the marketplace. And so it started we were talking about distance learning, and you were professor of chemistry classes, and you had an interesting student who later reached out to you. Can you just kind of start there from how that student and who that student was, and just all the way up into angel investor? I think that's a great way to end the show.
Yeah. So this class was one of three that is offered in satisfying the MIT chemistry requirement. Every student, regardless of what the student majors in, has to take one chemistry class, general chemistry, And there are two of them, two variants offered by the chemistry department. And then the variant that I was teaching, which is offered by the material science department. And over the years, my variant became popular. And out of the 1,000 students, MIT admits about 1,000 students per class. Mm-hmm. Out of 1,000, I was getting up over 500. At one point, it was over 600. But we don't have an auditorium that can hold that many. So they started to video record the lectures. And then as the internet got the capacity for streaming video, they would stream the video. And then around 2000, probably around year 2000, a couple of fellows, colleagues of mine in electrical engineering, went to see the president of MIT and made an outrageous proposal. They said, you know, now that you can stream video and so on, we propose that we take everything that MIT teaches and we put it on the web for free. And it was called OpenCourseWare.
Right.
And the president went for it. And so OpenCourseWare was born.
Okay.
And at one point they came to me and said, listen, you're recording all of your lectures, because they would record them and then broadcast them on closed circuit TV. Mm-hmm. So they played at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, six runs.
Right.
Guess which hour was most heavily viewed?
Probably not the one before lunch.
No, this is at night.
Oh, okay.
8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1 a.m.
I got to believe it's the 1 a.m.
That's right. It's MIT. They're living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, they're on Hawaiian time.
That's right.
So they're watching. Anyways, so then they started broadcasting these things. And one day I was waiting at a bus stop, and I get pinged a message. And someone says, I work for Microsoft, and I'm at the annual retreat, and Bill Gates has just given a state of the company lecture, and he talks about your chemistry lectures. He says he's been watching all of your chemistry lectures, and he's inviting us to do the same. Right? I thought, well, that's pretty cool, I guess. And then about several years later, I'd started this liquid metal battery thing, and I get an email from a woman who says that she's Bill Gates' personal assistant, and he's coming to Boston at the end of September, and he'd really like to meet with me. Mm-hmm. He's watching my chemistry, just continues to watch, mm-hmm. year after year, and would I have 90 minutes? And I ignored the email. And because I thought the students hacked into my account, they were just making a fool out of me. I said, I'm a good student. So I didn't answer. And then about, I don't know, a week or 10 days later, she wrote me again. Said, mm-hmm. maybe you didn't see the email, but Mr. Gates really wants to meet with you. Did you have an idea? So I showed it to some colleagues, and they said, I think this is real. So I said, okay. So I wrote her back and said, all right, yeah, as a matter of fact, I can see him. It's a teaching day. I'll see him right after class. And finally I said, would you mind telling me what this is about? And then she looped him in and we started exchanging. And he mm-hmm. was very methodical. And this is what he wants to talk about, and distance learning. So the day comes, and he comes to my, I meet him out front, on the steps in front of MIT. We go to my office. We sit down for 90 minutes and we talk about computers and education, distance learning. We talk about my class, he even makes some comments about, the camera work. Mm-hmm. we could up the game on the camera work and stuff like that. And towards the end, he says, so what are you working on in the lab mm-hmm. these days? And this was early. I didn't have any results. The student, David Bradwell, this was the early days. Mm-hmm. We were struggling to get anything to work. But I sketched it out on a whiteboard. Mm-hmm. And he looked at it and he says, if you ever decide to spin that out as a company, let me know. I'd be willing to put some money in. And then a couple of years later, the two students said, we're going to go see Bill. Mm-hmm. And off they went. And that eventually he became our first investor. And so I like to say that I met Bill Gates not because I wrote a dynamite op-ed piece for the Wall Street Journal. I met Bill Gates because I was dutifully teaching freshman chemistry. That's a story you can tell in next company.
Yes, it is. And it's a fantastic story. And it's for technology optimists like me, and obviously like you, it gives me hope that the universe is going to help us out in the end, that we're not just going to, after the last year of pandemics and political intrigue and whatever, that there is there's opportunity and optimism to be had. Sir, thank you so much for coming on my show. Truly, it's been an honor for me. We will have links down below to select pieces to the different companies that you've started, and maybe even to some of the online classes that are available. Thank you so much. And thanks for educating my audience. I really appreciate it today.
My pleasure.
All right, Professor Sadoway, thank you for coming on the QTS Experience. I hope to talk to you again another time. Take care.
We'll see you.
All right. Bye-bye.